I told myself I needed one more data point, one more moment that proved I wasn't being dramatic, one more confirmation that it wasn't just awkwardness or my own sensitivity misfiring in a place that ran on pressure and caffeine and late-night deadlines. But that's what harassment does when it's wrapped in charm and delivered in a tone that sounds like a compliment. It turns your instincts into a debate. It makes you cross-examine your own body like it's unreliable testimony. The first time he did it, it was small enough to shrug off, a hand on the small of my back as he passed behind my chair. It lingered just a second too long. His fingers pressed like he owned the space around me. I felt my spine stiffen, my shoulders draw up like I was protecting something fragile. He leaned in close to look at my screen, and his breath hit my ear. He said something low, something that made me feel like I'd been touched twice. I didn't say anything. I smiled the way women smile when they're trying to keep a situation from turning ugly. I moved my chair forward. I told myself he was just too familiar, too social, too used to being liked. I also told myself I could handle it. That was my first mistake, because in workplaces like mine, handling it quietly is basically a donation. It's a free trial of what you'll tolerate. And he was the kind of man who knew how to use silence like a permission slip. I thought the hard part would be saying the words out loud. I thought the hard part would be walking into that glass-walled meeting room with my throat tight and my hands sweaty and telling HR that a colleague had crossed a line that didn't just make me uncomfortable, but made me afraid to be alone with him. I thought the hard part would be the shame that clung to me like perfume I didn't choose. I was wrong. The hard part was what came after. The stillness. The way my team stopped inviting me into side conversations like I'd become a risk. The way my calendar emptied out, one meeting at a time, like someone was slowly erasing me. The way my manager's voice went careful and flat. The way he looked past me instead of at me. And then the performance plan landed in my inbox. Not his. It was written in polite language and formatted like a formal gift. It listed concerns I'd never been told about. It turned my work into a problem and my personality into a liability. It came with a timeline, a check-in schedule, and the quiet understanding that I had entered the part of the story where the workplace protects itself. Reporting didn't make me safer. It made me expensive. I worked for a mid-sized tech services company in the north of Italy. The kind of place that liked to call itself modern because it had an espresso machine and exposed brick. We built tools for other businesses, dashboards and systems that promised efficiency. Our clients were old money and old habits, so we sold them the future in clean interfaces and confident meetings. Inside, it was all hierarchy and temperament. My department was project delivery. We were the ones who carried the promises the sales team made. We were the ones who stayed late when scope expanded. We were the ones who got blamed when a client changed their mind and still wanted the deadline unchanged. I had a role that didn't sound powerful, but was powerful in the way certain jobs become essential. I was the operational lead on three major accounts. I kept timelines alive. I caught mistakes before they became disasters. I translated between developers and clients who talked like they were ordering a meal. I'd been there 4 years, long enough to know who actually made decisions and who just pretended, long enough to understand that my manager, Luca, was more concerned with being liked by upper management than protecting anyone below him. And then there was Matteo. Matteo wasn't in my reporting line. That was important because it gave him plausible distance. He was a senior account strategist, the face that clients loved, the man who knew how to tilt his head when you spoke so you felt like you were being heard even when you weren't. He wore well-cut shirts and a watch he didn't need. He spoke with that warm, slightly amused tone that made people lean in. He did the kind of flirting that could be denied in court because it was always delivered like a joke. He was also close with the director, the kind of close that came from years of dinners and shared stories. He was untouchable in the way some men become untouchable simply because people enjoy them. When Matteo first joined a project I was leading, he was helpful. That was his opening move. He offered to take pressure off me. He praised my work publicly. He told Luca I was a real asset and Luca started smiling at me more in meetings like he just discovered I existed. Then Matteo started doing it in private, a compliment that lasted too long, a comment about how I looked tired and how he liked me a little wild, a joke about us being the only two adults in the room, delivered like we were in on something together. At first, I did what so many women do. I adjusted. I stopped staying late alone. I started taking calls with my door open. I positioned myself in meeting rooms so I wasn't trapped against a wall. I avoided elevators when it was just the two of us. I told myself I was being smart. But the more you adjust around a man's behavior, the more the workplace treats your adjustments as evidence that the situation is manageable. It's not a crisis. It's not urgent. It's not their problem. One afternoon, after a client meeting ran long, Matteo caught up with me in the hallway. The office was quieter than usual. Half the staff had already left. The lights were softer. The air had that after-hours feeling, like the building itself was tired. He walked beside me, close enough that our arms brushed. He said he liked how I handled the client. He said I was dangerously competent. He said it like it was sexy. I laughed, because that's what people do when they're trying to keep something light. He took that laugh like a green light. He reached out and tucked a loose strand of hair behind my ear. His fingertips skimmed the side of my neck. It was intimate in a way that didn't belong at work. It wasn't accidental. It wasn't friendly. It was claiming. My body reacted before my brain finished processing. My stomach dropped. My skin went cold. I stepped back too fast. I said, still smiling because I couldn't make my face stop, that he shouldn't do that. He raised his hands like he was innocent. He said I was misreading him. He said he was just being kind. He said I was too intense. I hated that part the most, the quick pivot. The way he made my discomfort sound like a personality flaw. After that, he became careful in public. He stayed charming. He stayed helpful. He just found new ways to get close in moments that weren't witnessed. He'd stand behind my chair when I was working and make comments about my perfume. He'd lean in too close when showing me something on his phone. He'd message me late at night with work thoughts that turned into personal observations. I didn't respond. I kept it short, professional, dry, and slowly my silence stopped being enough for him. He wanted a reaction. He wanted proof he could move me. The warning sign wasn't only his behavior. It was the way people laughed at him like he was harmless. It was the way women rolled their eyes and said, "That's Matteo," like it was a weather pattern. It was the way Luca never noticed anything unless it affected his reports. It was the way HR was treated like a branding department, not a protection system. I knew all that. I knew the terrain. And still, when the incident finally happened, it shook me enough that I couldn't pretend anymore. It was after a quarterly review. We'd hosted clients in our conference room, served pastries and espresso, put on our best professionalism. When they left, people drifted back to their desks. The adrenaline wore off. The office settled. Matteo stopped by my workstation and said he wanted to debrief. He pointed toward a small meeting room near the back. It had frosted glass, just opaque enough to feel private. I should have said no. I should have suggested we talk out in the open. Instead, I followed him, because I was tired, because it seemed normal, because the whole world is built on women's willingness to keep things smooth. Inside the room, he closed the door. He leaned against the table, casual, smiling. He said the meeting went well. He said the client liked me. He said he liked me. Then he walked closer. He stood right in front of me, close enough that I could smell his cologne. He looked down at me, like he was testing something. He said I worked too hard. He said I needed someone to take care of me. He reached out, and his hand landed on my hip, not my shoulder, not my arm, but my hip, like we were already intimate. He squeezed slightly, like he was checking if I would pull away. My throat went tight. My voice felt trapped behind my teeth. I stepped back and said, "Clearly this time, don't touch me." He didn't step back immediately. He smiled like I was flirting. He said, "Come on." And then he leaned in, as if he was going to kiss me. Something in me snapped into motion. I pushed him away hard enough that he stumbled a little. My chair scraped the floor behind me with a sharp sound that made the room suddenly feel loud. I opened the door and walked out without looking back. My hands were shaking so badly I could barely type. I sat at my desk and stared at my screen like it could tell me what to do next. That was the moment I understood something I'd been trying not to understand. It wasn't misunderstanding. It wasn't friendliness. It wasn't charm. It was entitlement. And he had tested it in a room with a door he could close. That night, I didn't sleep. I kept replaying it, the hand on my hip, the smile, the way he didn't stop when I said no, the way I'd had to push him. I could still feel the pressure of his fingers on my body, like a bruise that hadn't formed yet. By morning, my exhaustion had turned into something sharper. Anger, not dramatic anger, not the kind that makes speeches, the kind that makes you realize you will hate yourself if you say nothing. So I booked a meeting with HR. I wrote the email carefully, like I was placing explosives in a box labeled fragile. I asked for discretion. I said I needed to report inappropriate behavior. And then I sat at my desk with my stomach tight, waiting for the clock to drag me into that meeting. Our HR manager was named Sylvia. She was in her late 30s, always impeccably styled, always slightly rushed. She had the energy of someone who was constantly managing perception. Her office smelled like vanilla and printer toner. When I walked in, she smiled like this was going to be a routine conversation. I told her I needed to report Mateo. Sylvia's smile shifted. It didn't disappear, but it tightened. Her eyebrows lifted in a quick flash of concern that looked practiced. She asked me to sit. I started from the beginning. Not everything, not every uncomfortable comment, because even then, I was filtering myself. I focused on the incident in the meeting room, the touching, the attempt to kiss me after I told him not to touch me. Sylvia nodded. She wrote notes. She asked questions that sounded neutral but felt like a test. Had I ever told him directly to stop before? Was there any misunderstanding? Had he been drinking? Was anyone nearby? Did I have messages? I pulled up the late-night texts. I showed her the ones that blurred the line between work and personal. Nothing explicit, nothing that screamed harassment, but enough that the tone made my skin crawl. Sylvia looked at them and said softly, "He's very friendly with everyone." That phrase landed like a slap. Friendly with everyone, as if my body was part of the office culture. I said yes, but he touched me. He tried to kiss me. I told him no. Sylvia leaned back in her chair and said she would investigate. She said they took these matters seriously. She said retaliation was not tolerated. She said all the right things, but her eyes avoided mine more than once, and I noticed something else. She didn't look surprised. She looked inconvenienced. After the meeting, she told me she would need to inform my manager, Luca, because it involved workplace conduct and needed managerial awareness. I didn't like that, but I understood the mechanics. I told myself it was part of the process. I walked out of her office feeling raw, but also relieved, like I had finally handed off a weight I'd been carrying alone. The relief lasted exactly one day. The next morning, Luca asked me to come into his office. His office was small and bright, with a plant that was dying and a framed certificate on the wall that no one had ever mentioned. He didn't offer me coffee. He didn't smile. He sat behind his desk and folded his hands like he was about to deliver bad news. He said he'd been informed I had concerns about Mateo. Concerns, not harassment, not touching, concerns. His voice was calm. In that way, men get calm when they're preparing to make you feel unreasonable. He said he was disappointed I hadn't come to him first. He said Mateo was a valuable member of the team. He said these situations can get messy. He said, and I remember this clearly, that I should be careful not to damage relationships in the department. I stared at him for a second, waiting for the part where he said, "I'm sorry this happened. Are you okay? We'll make sure you're safe." That part didn't come. Instead, he said, "We have to consider how this affects the team's performance." And then he asked me if I could still work with Mateo professionally. The question felt insane, like asking someone if they could still enjoy the office after a small fire in their corner. I said I could be professional, but I didn't want to be alone with him. Luca sighed like I had just made his day harder. He said, "We'll see what we can do." When I left his office, I felt something shift around me, not in a dramatic way, in small, measurable changes. People stopped making eye contact. My colleagues became polite, too polite, like they were afraid of saying the wrong thing and being pulled into it. Two women I used to eat lunch with suddenly had meetings when I invited them. One of them sent me a message later saying she was sorry, she was just busy. Her tone felt like a wall. In meetings, Luca stopped calling on me. He spoke to me less. When I spoke, he nodded without warmth. Matteo, meanwhile, didn't avoid me. He approached me at my desk with a pleasant smile and said, "I hear you're upset." He said it like it was gossip. He said he didn't know what he did wrong. He said he would never make me uncomfortable intentionally. He said with a small laugh that maybe I should relax. That was the moment I realized he'd already been told. Not officially maybe, but enough. He knew I had reported him, and he was walking around with no fear at all. I went back to Sylvia in HR and asked if Matteo had been informed. She said they had to speak with him as part of the investigation. I asked what measures were being taken to keep us separated. She said they couldn't disrupt business operations without a finding. Without a finding, meaning, until the company officially decided he had done something wrong, I had to keep working in the same environment as him. I asked if I could move desks, switch projects, something. She said they could explore options, but it might look like I was unable to perform my duties. That phrase stayed with me. Unable to perform my duties. As if my safety was a weakness. As if my discomfort was an efficiency issue. Over the next week, the investigation unfolded like a slow punishment. Sylvia asked me to write a formal statement. I did. I described the meeting room incident with careful language that made my skin crawl because I was trying to be precise without sounding emotional. I attached screenshots of the messages that supported the pattern. Then she asked me again for dates, times, context. She asked me if I had ever flirted with Matteo. I stared at her and said no. She asked me if I had ever gone for drinks with him outside of work. I said no. She asked me if I had ever complimented him. I said, "I compliment colleagues on work." She nodded like she was checking boxes. It felt less like I was being protected and more like I was being evaluated. During this time, Matteo became a master of performance. In meetings, he was respectful. He used my name formally. He praised my work in a way that sounded supportive but felt like a strategy. Outside of meetings, he would stand near my desk and talk loudly to others about how false accusations ruin careers. He didn't say my name. He didn't need to. Once, I heard him in the kitchen telling someone that some women mistake kindness for interest because they want attention. He laughed while saying it. People laughed with him. That's when the cold shoulder from my team stopped feeling accidental and started feeling organized. Not officially, not in writing, but socially, yes. They had made a choice. They had decided which discomfort mattered more, mine or the discomfort of dealing with a popular man being held accountable. Luca called me into his office again 2 weeks after my report. This time, he had papers on his desk. He didn't slide them to me immediately. He talked first, slowly, carefully, like he was setting up a trap. He said he wanted to talk about performance. He said he'd noticed I seemed distracted lately. He said some deadlines had slipped, though he didn't name which ones. He said he'd received feedback that I was difficult to approach. I felt my face get hot. I asked him why this was coming up now. He said, calmly, that it was his responsibility to address concerns when they arose. Concerns. Again, he slid the paper across the desk. It was a performance improvement plan. A PIP. I had heard of them, of course. Everyone has. The corporate way of building a case against someone while pretending its support. The document was formatted perfectly. It listed expectations. It listed measurable goals. It listed weekly check-ins. It also contained things that were subjective. Communication tone, team collaboration, responsiveness. The kind of things you can never fully prove. The kind of things people use when they want you gone without saying why. My mouth went dry. I said, "Is this because I reported Matteo?" Luca's eyes narrowed slightly, the smallest shift. He said, "Absolutely not." He said, "We don't retaliate." He said, "This is about performance." He said, and this was the part that made me want to scream, that stress can make people see things differently. See things differently. As if my report was a stress hallucination. I left his office with the paper in my hand and the sensation that the floor had tilted. I went to the bathroom and locked myself in a stall. I stared at the PIP like it was a document from another language. My chest felt tight. I realized what was happening. They weren't going to punish Matteo. They were going to punish me for making them deal with it. because harassment complaints aren't treated like safety issues. They're treated like disruptions, and disruptions cost money. Sylvia in HR scheduled a follow-up meeting with me the next day. She said she wanted to check in and update me on the investigation. When I sat down in her office, she looked at me with a careful expression that I had started to recognize. The corporate sympathy face, the one that says, "I'm going to disappoint you, but I want you to think I tried." She said they had spoken with Mateo. She said he denied any inappropriate intent. She said he claimed the touch was accidental, a friendly gesture, misunderstood. She said there were no witnesses. She said the messages were suggestive, but not explicit. She said, therefore, they could not substantiate the complaint as harassment. Not substantiate. The words tasted like metal. I asked what would happen now. She said they would remind Mateo of appropriate workplace boundaries. She said they would recommend training. She said they would close the case. I asked her if my performance plan was being discussed in relation to this. Sylvia blinked, like she hadn't expected me to connect the dots. She said performance management was handled by my manager. She said HR supported fair processes. Fair processes. I felt like I was in a room where everyone spoke a language designed to avoid responsibility. I said, "I'm being punished." Sylvia's voice softened. She said she understood it felt that way. Felt, again, with the framing of my reality as a feeling. She said maybe it would be best if I took some time off to rest, to reset. Time off in that moment sounded like exile. I left HR and walked back to my desk. The office looked the same, the screens, the coffee cups, the little jokes on sticky notes, but it felt like I had become a cautionary tale. People glanced at me and looked away quickly. Mateo walked past my desk later that afternoon and didn't even look at me. He didn't have to. He had won, and I had a pip in my inbox. That's when the pressure turned into something else. Not just fear, not just anger. Something heavier, a realization that if I stayed, I would be slowly erased. And if I left, they would treat it like proof that I was unstable. Either way, the company would be clean. Only I would carry the stain. The next month was a slow grind of humiliation disguised as support. Every week, Luca met with me for pip check-ins. He asked me to update him on tasks that had never required updates before. He requested written summaries for meetings I'd already attended. He asked me to copy him on emails that didn't involve him. He wasn't improving my performance. He was creating a paper trail. In team meetings, Mateo continued to operate like nothing happened. He joked, he smiled, he leaned toward colleagues with that familiar charm. The office atmosphere slowly relaxed again, but not around me. Around me, people remained cautious, like I was the problem that might flare up again. I stopped eating lunch with others. I ate at my desk, pretending I was too busy, when really I couldn't handle the way conversations died when I approached. I started getting left out of decisions that affected my projects. People made changes without telling me, and then acted surprised when I didn't know. Luca framed these moments as evidence that I wasn't staying on top of communication. Mateo never touched me again. He didn't need to. He had learned a more effective way to control me. He let the system do it. One afternoon, I walked into the kitchen to refill my water bottle and overheard two colleagues talking. They didn't see me immediately. Their voices were low, casual. One of them said, "She's too much drama." The other said, "Yeah, and you know how it is. If she's making accusations, it's risky to be close." Risky. That word cut deeper than the pip. It meant my colleagues had absorbed the company's message. That being associated with me was dangerous. That my discomfort was contagious. I walked back to my desk without saying anything. I sat down and stared at my screen, and for a moment I couldn't remember what I was supposed to do next. That was the residue of it. The way your mind starts to lose its own clarity because your environment keeps rewriting your value. I started documenting everything, not because I wanted to become someone who lived in a folder of screenshots, but because it was the only way I could keep my own reality intact. Every pip meeting summary, every email that changed expectations without notice, every moment Mateo made a pointed comment about accusations, every time Luca framed my reactions as instability, it became my private archive of proof that I wasn't imagining it. At the same time, I started looking for another job, quietly, carefully, the way you do when you know your current workplace would treat your departure like betrayal. Interviews were strange at first. I would sit across from another manager in another building and feel like I was pretending to be fine, like I was selling a version of myself that hadn't been damaged by the last few months. They asked why I was leaving. I said I was looking for growth. I said I wanted new challenges. I didn't say because I reported harassment and my company tried to bury me. You learn quickly which truths are allowed in professional settings. Most aren't. A few weeks later, Luca scheduled a meeting with me and Sylvia together. That was new. The invite came with no explanation. I walked into the meeting room and saw Sylvia sitting there with her laptop open. Luca's expression was neutral, but his jaw looked tight. They didn't offer me water. They didn't ask how I was doing. Luca said they wanted to discuss my progress. Sylvia said she was there to ensure the process was fair. Luca said I had made some improvements, but not enough. He said there were ongoing concerns about my attitude and collaboration. He said the team felt tension around me. The team, always the team. As if the team was a living creature that needed protecting from me. Sylvia nodded. I asked directly what was going to happen. Sylvia said they wanted to explore options. She said sometimes when a role is no longer a good fit, it's better for everyone to transition. Transition. Again, the language that makes decisions sound mutual when they aren't. She said they could offer a separation agreement. She said it would include a small payout. She said it would be confidential. Confidential. That word made my stomach twist, because now it was clear. They weren't just pushing me out. They wanted silence as part of the exit. I sat there and felt my body go very still. I felt like I was watching myself from far away, like my mind had stepped back to survive. I thought about what would happen if I refused. They could fire me. They could drag out the pip. They could make my days even colder. I also thought about what would happen if I accepted. I would leave, and they would get to say it was performance. I would lose my job, and they would keep Mateo. That was the bargain. Sylvia said, gently, that this didn't have to be adversarial. I looked at her, and for the first time I saw her clearly. She wasn't my ally. She was the company's witness. I told them I needed time to review the agreement. Sylvia said, of course. Luca looked relieved, like he was grateful I wasn't making a scene. When I left the room, my hands were shaking. But underneath the shaking was something sharp, a clarity. It wasn't going to get better there. There was no version of this where I stayed and reclaimed my place. They had already decided who mattered more, and it wasn't me. I spoke to a lawyer briefly, just to understand my options. Not because I wanted a legal battle, but because I needed to know what I was walking into. I needed to understand the power they had and the power I still had left. The lawyer said the case would be difficult without witnesses. He said companies know that. He said these situations often end in settlements and silence. Silence again. It was always silence. At the same time, I got an offer from another company, a smaller one, not glamorous. But the manager I interviewed with looked me in the eye when he spoke. He asked real questions. He didn't perform warmth. He just seemed solid. I accepted. Then I went back to Luca and Sylvia and told them I was resigning. Their reaction was immediate relief, disguised as professionalism. Sylvia said she was sorry it had come to this. Luca said he wished me well. Nobody said, "We failed you." Nobody said, "We're sorry you were hurt here." My last 2 weeks were surreal. People were suddenly friendly again, because now I was leaving and no longer a threat. Colleagues who had avoided me asked where I was going. They smiled. They wished me luck. Mateo walked past my desk on my last day and said, casually, "Good luck out there." His tone was light, like we were just co-workers exchanging politeness. I looked at him and felt something close to nausea. I wanted to say everything. I wanted to tell him he wasn't charming, he was predatory. That he hadn't just touched me, he had tested me. That the company hadn't just failed, it had collaborated. But I didn't. I nodded once and walked away. Because the truth is, by then, the workplace had already taught me the cost of speaking. I walked out of that building with my belongings in a box and the feeling that I had survived something invisible. But it didn't disappear when I left. For months after, I flinched when men stood too close behind me. I checked doors and meeting rooms. I kept my tone sharp and neutral, afraid that warmth could be misinterpreted and used against me. I also carried something else, a bitter understanding. When a company says it doesn't tolerate retaliation, what it often means is it doesn't tolerate obvious retaliation. It doesn't tolerate things that leave fingerprints. It doesn't tolerate anything that might embarrass them publicly. But quiet punishment? That's easy. A performance plan, a cold shoulder, a subtle shift in who gets invited into meetings, a slow draining of trust. It's all deniable. It's all clean. And it sends the message without ever needing to say it. Reporting is expensive, not for them, for you. That's what I learned. Not from Mateo's hand on my hip, not from his smile when I said no, but from the way the system moved, smoothly and politely, to protect itself. And if I'm being honest, the part that still sits in my chest isn't only anger. It's the memory of how quickly everyone understood the rules, how quickly they chose comfort over truth, how quickly they let me become the problem just for insisting that what happened to me mattered. Because that's the real backfire. Not that the complaint didn't stick, but that the act of speaking up turned me into a liability. And once you're a liability, everything about you becomes negotiable.